G'day listeners, Jono here just to let you know that Truth To You is now publishing a free monthly newsletter containing highlights and commentary from forthcoming Torah Pearls programs with Nehemiah Gordon and Keith Johnson, as well as updates on recent guests and topics. If you would like to receive the monthly newsletter, simply go to truthtoyou.org, that's truth2letteryou.org, and register your email address.
That's a very, very important role that I think has been lost throughout the centuries in the Jewish world, because we've developed a lot of traditions, and we're going to speak about very specific ones. Jews have developed a lot, many, many traditions. None of them are problematic or harmful, except for ones which go against Torah, which I can't think of too many of them. Except for, remember when we spoke about Yom Kippur, I was talking a lot against the whole chicken thing. And you're saying, take your chicken in your hand, swing it round and round, something like that. It was very nice.
The chicken slaughter day. And I suppose, obviously, traditions that claim that God has put them in place where there's actually no scriptural evidence for something like that, that's also problematic. But but traditions can be good.
I would say that traditions define us as people. We all have our own personal traditions. We also have traditions as communities. I think when we start developing traditions over the commandments of the Torah, that's where we cross the line of adding and reducing from the Torah. But if we have traditions, I don't know, we wear this hat, we wear that hat, but we don't take it religiously. We just know this is what we wear. Fine, that's not an issue. But when I was in the ultra-Orthodox world, I was ultra-Orthodox for like 6 or 7 years. And I reached a point where I got fed up of this religious fanaticism over the issue of clothing. Now, we want to define ourselves. Fine, let's take things which, let's say, okay, we do this, but let's not be fanatic about it. But I met people, they wouldn't do something. For example, I wanna say the blessing over the food, I have to wear my hat. It's like, what? What does that have to do with anything? We can argue down to a blue in the face if there's even a commandment to say a blessing over your food. Maybe the verse there in Deuteronomy is more of a general concept of always to be thankful that you have what you receive and everything. So it goes overboard. So let me give a few examples of things which are done in the Jewish world, which can give you an idea what happens. Sure. So if you want to take something which is a bit religiously overboard, is the issue of always eating something hot during Shabbat. There's a technical reason why it's the tradition exists.
Hang on. Do you mean hot as in like a chili, or do you mean hot as in temperature?
I mean hot as temperature, in temperature. Okay. So one of the traditions that we have is eating hot food. When I mean hot, I mean in temperature, not the spicy food. But what we do find is fanatic. I would describe it as fanatic. You have to eat hot food in during Shabbat. So when it comes to hot food, I mean, for example, hot beverages, food that's heated up during Shabbat. And the reason it's done is because there was an argument with some of the early Karaites, or even before the Karaites. This was stated way before even the Karaites. But there were many, many Jewish groups that did not have a fire burning during Shabbat. So they would eat cold food during Shabbat. So they would say anyone who eats cold food during Shabbat is suspected to be a non-believer in the words of the rabbis.
Oh, that is so bizarre. Because you and I have just had a long conversation about, Exodus 35 verse 3 and Exodus 16 and all of these things in regards to Shabbat. Now you're telling me there's a tradition to eat something hot. You've got to explain this to me.
But that's the issue. That's how it started. They said, we want to make sure that, if you go to someone's house and they're serving you cold food, you have to start suspecting them. This is already what we can call mind control, thought police type of style. Yeah. But this is sometimes what you find.
Hang on, wait. What are you suspecting them of?
They don't believe in what the rabbis say.
Oh.
Because at that time, the division, we don't have the type of thinking we have today. Uh-huh. At that time, the division was you have fire or you don't have fire.
Uh-huh.
That was the division. There were only two opinions.
Yes.
So if you didn't have fire, it meant you tried to interpret the words that there's no fire burning, which means you're interpreting against what the rabbis say. So they always made sure if you're eating cold food, you have to start suspecting this person is not a faithful Jew of the words of the rabbis. So this is something that went on for centuries, and it's one of the classic things. It's one of the classic things. I once had a cold meal home because we were having cold cuts and stuff like that,
uh-huh.
and I invited a friend over.
Uh-huh.
Now, every good, respectful, Orthodox Jew expects you to have hot food in every meal.
Mm-hmm.
Guy comes in my house and there's salads and very high quality cold cuts, sometimes stuff I make by myself.
Sure.
And he looks at me and says, "Why are you eating cold food?" I said, "Why not?" He says to me, and then he quotes this sentence from the Talmud about the issue of cold food during Shabbat.
Uh-huh.
And I looked at it and said, "Either you eat or you don't. I don't care. I'm going to enjoy this meal."
I have to ask you, so there is still a tradition to eat something hot on Shabbat, which means that if you come to the conclusion that you're not to cook on Shabbat, you still have to cook on Shabbat. I don't understand. You're going to have to explain yourself a little bit more.
Okay, let me explain that. What we have is what we call a hot plate.
Mm-hmm.
And the hot plate is not something which you can really cook on, but it heats up your food to a reasonable temperature.
Uh-huh.
The different types of hot plates, some of them have a bit of a problem. They heat the food too much, but most of it heats up the food to a temperature which makes it not edible, but beyond edible. Basically, hot enough to eat and you feel okay with it, as if you just cooked it.
Right.
You can't cook. What it does, it can dehydrate your food, but it doesn't really cook. You can't fry an egg on it or something. It warms up the food, it warms up the plate, you can uh-huh. place things on it, but it takes a very long time. You place your food on it. If you, for example, you take soup,
soup, for example, this is stuff that you've already prepared. It's already been cooked, but you're warming it on. Yeah, okay, I see what you're saying. Right, I'm with you.
Exactly. So it's already cooked. You can't prepare anything on it.
Mm-hmm.
If you put non-cooked food on it, it's going to stay raw. It's not going to cook.
Sure.
That's one of the things. So you're not really cooking. You're just heating it up.
Okay.
So
that's just to show your dedication to the rabbinical interpretation.
No, because most people want to eat hot food. No one wants to eat cold food. Part of it has to do with the issue of, there's always this thing about eating hot food.
Uh-huh.
So, for example, one of the things that we have, there's this dish called, it depends where you come from, but it's basically, it's almost like a pot roast sometimes, a pot roast or some kind of heavy stew.
Mm-hmm.
And every Jewish community has this. It's kind of funny. Everyone has the exact same, almost exact same thing.
Really?
Beef or chicken, beans or garbanzo, also known as chickpeas,
mm-hmm.
Some kind of maybe potatoes, sometimes potatoes, or something which will be a carbohydrate. It's all put into like one pot and left in on this hot plate throughout the entire night. When you open it up on Shabbat morning or Shabbat late morning, you have a slow, it's ready. You have to place it when it's already cooked, but what you're doing, you're aging the dish, so there's more flavor. It's heavier.
Sure.
And by the way, if you have a wintry day and it's during Shabbat and you sit down with this and it's fun. You sit there, it's cooking outside, they're having this wonderful bowl of aged stew.
Nice.
It's just out of this world. The beans go soft. The meat is tender. Some people place eggs inside, non-cooked eggs. Mm. They place them inside. Let them cook over the night. They go brown.
It's just like a slow cooker.
Nice.
Yeah.
It's like a slow cooker. Exactly. That's exactly what you're doing.
Yeah.
So you can You can make this thing with a slow cooker, and that's what some people do.
Brilliant.
Now, so that's one tradition, this dish. So some people call it chamin, from the word cham, which means hot.
Mm-hmm.
So they actually gave it the name, influenced by the whole issue of eating something hot. Now, let's go into more classical traditions that everyone knows of. So first of all, there's the one called Kabbalat Shabbat. Everyone tells me about this Kabbalat Shabbat they do. And there's different practices. For example, one of the first stages you do to perform Shabbat is Orthodox Jews will do. First of all, you prepare all the food that you need.
Mm-hmm.
When I actually get around to cooking for Shabbat, I'm done in like 2-3 hours. We're talking about several meals for about 24 hours.
Mm.
So I'm done in like 2-3 hours because that's me, because I'm trained in cooking. For example, my mother-in-law hates cooking, so she wants to be done as fast as she can. So every time we come over, she calls me, yo, can you come help me in the kitchen? I'm like, okay.
So get it over and done with.
Yeah, you work 3 hours on something, and it's gone in 5 minutes. Okay, so that's stage number one. Another thing that everyone does is clean the house. So basically, Thursday, Friday is the time when you start cleaning the house.
Sure.
You vacuum the carpets, you wash the floor. If you have, here in Israel, we have tiles. You don't have wooden floor or anything. We have tiles.
Mm-hmm.
So wash the floor with water and soap. Clean everything out. There's things you clean almost every day, but there's things that you get around, you get around to doing the cleaning. So everyone chips in.
Mm-hmm.
Friday, unless the father is working. So the father also helps out in the house. They clean, they wash. I've seen all the time people wash everything.
Mm-hmm.
It's very children help.
Yeah.
You see kids taking the trash out, tidying up their toys, everything. But by the time that's over, the house is sparkling clean, smells nice.
Yes.
And even families, for example, there's families that have, for example, I don't know, 10 kids, the house can be a mess throughout the entire week.
Mm.
Shabbat, the house is tidy.
Yes.
And even,
if no one is coming over, it's as if somebody is coming over and you're tidying it up because you want it to be presentable and you want it to be spotless by the time that Shabbat comes around.
So here's I just love what you just said, as if someone's coming.
Mm.
I'm just overwhelmed with the fact that you said that, because one of the attitudes in the Jewish world is that Shabbat is a guest.
Mm. Yeah, so that's beautiful.
I'm just like, wow, you said that, and I'm like, I was about to lead into that. You just said that, and I'm like, wow, you hit something. And yes, that's one of the attitudes. So we treat Shabbat as if it's a guest. So now, if we do that, we go into the issue of Kabbalat Shabbat. So first of all, lighting of candles. There's a tradition, a rabbinical tradition, to light candles before Shabbat. We're not going to go at the moment to the whole issue of it, that the Zoroastrians had a very similar custom when they had festivals and stuff like that. We light two candles on the table. We're not going to go there, light one candle, two candles, but there's a practice to light a candle. You say a blessing over it,
which is another
issue, because the Torah does not command you to light candles before Shabbat. So how can you say, which is
This is something that I've been wanting to ask you about for a while, because, particularly coming from my tradition, the religion that I've come from, when you start to realize that the Tanakh is a Hebrew book and so on and so forth, one of the first things that I've noticed a lot of people do is they run to Fiddler on the Roof. They think, okay, Jewish, I've got to start thinking Jewish. What do I do? Oh, Fiddler on the Roof. So they get that and they start adopting things out of there. And, of course, there is that beautiful scene, that beautiful scene of when the mother lights the candles and everyone's watching intently going, what does this mean? This is obviously a tradition. And then they sing that song, the Song of the Blessing, and it really is a very touching moment. But a lot of people take that on board without really giving it too much thought and or investigation. So you better give it to us, I think.
Okay. So first of all, we don't see in the Torah or anything that says you have to light candles.
Mm-hmm.
I would say if you say you're allowed to have a fire burning, you would want some kind of light. So actually the whole issue of lighting the candles before Shabbat was a practical issue. We need light in the house during night.
Sure.
At least during the time that we're still awake. Because one of the practices is also stay awake a bit later. People used to go to sleep when night came.
Mm-hmm.
During Shabbat, people stayed awake a bit later than that. So they had to have some light. So it was a practical issue. But in time, tradition became law. So now that we have this tradition to light candles, we're going to turn it into a commandment. And that's where the rabbis started intervening and interfering.
Yes.
And they said, no, you have to say a commandment. Now, they agree that it's a rabbinical commandment to do this, but they have this whole analogy, which we're not going to go into at the moment, but about what the elders tell you is like the Torah tells you. There's a whole very strange analogy there. We maybe might do a lesson about oral law and the origins of oral law, and then try to explain that. But it became one of the symbols of Shabbat, one of the practices of Shabbat. So they said you have to say a blessing over that. But essentially, let me be very, very specific. If the intention is to light a candle, just say have light and you just, today we have electricity, so just switch on the electricity and leave it on. That's what many of us do. We have the practice for lighting the candles, but we really switch on the lights and we just leave them on. And we have a timer. Well, many of us have a timer in the electrical box that we can actually switch it on, and it turns the lights on and off for you at specific times.
So that's the practicality of lights. But what about right at the very beginning? She lights the candles, and then she waves her hands over the flame twice, and then puts her hands on her eyes. What's that about? What's the meaning of that?
Again, it's the issue of embracing the light and everything. I'll tell you something. I spoke with a man who studied witchcraft, who knows a lot about witchcraft. And when I spoke with him about this, his response was, this is classic candle magic. The waving of the hands and face on your head, it's bringing the light. This is what's called white magic. He was, this man's he used to be an Orthodox Jew, and we had like a 3-hour conversation about practices in Judaism. And he pointed out, and he told me, I have spoken with people who practice this type of magic. I've seen books and everything, and his response was, this is pure magic.
Okay,
this conversation, I actually told my wife to stop doing the whole waving hands and everything. I said, light the candles, just forget about it. So let's be very specific here as well, that Zoroastrians are fire worshippers. Mm-hmm. They have the 7 elements that they worship. Mm-hmm. One of them, the major element is fire. That's the big element. That's the element that belongs to the deity itself, or maybe the highest ranking angel that the Zoroastrians believe in. And they have a very similar practice where you place the candles at the area where you're going to have your feast. Mm-hmm. We do the exact same thing in Judaism. Sure. Where you're going to eat is where you light your candles. Mm-hmm. So it's no longer a practical, only a practical thing. Because if my issue is to have candles lit, I'll be spreading the candles around the house. It'll be light everywhere.
Yeah, well, that's right. But this clearly has I was just going to say, it clearly has a mystical significance to it as well. But what are the women told? Like in Judaism, what does it mean to them today to do that? Or is there no? Is it just something that is done?
Everything has an inner meaning. You do this, you have a blessing for this. You do that. They take even commandments of the Torah, for example, issues of tithe. If you will do this, you have a blessing of whatever it would be, hocus pocus. And the thing is, like, this is taking the commandments of the Torah and turning them into magic. For example, there's a practice to, the Torah says, just after the dispute with Korach, it says that they, by the way, notice I'm not quoting chapters because this is not the way we think. The whole chapter system it was invented by the Christians, by the early Christians. So some Jews will know the chapters, some won't. I'm from the types who don't know the chapters. We have this basically a flow in our head of all the stories, everything that's described this. We find things based on location because when you open up a Torah scroll, you don't have chapters. So you have to know what you're reading. So this is a training that you get to when you open up a Torah scroll, not when you open up a regular Bible.
Sure.
Just to point that out. So I do apologize if you're looking for it. You know, I'm sorry. I don't know what to tell you what a chapter is. But after the story with Korach, they start talking about the things that you promised to Aaron and his family. One of them is bread. When you make a dough, you're supposed to give a Kohen part of the bread. We're not going to go into that why, who, what, and how. But today is like, if you take that piece of dough, if you're not married, you'll get married. If you're married, you have children. If your children are older, they'll get married. Everything becomes magic. Everything comes, all the Torah. It's no longer that do the Torah and God will bless you. It's not very specific. That's already flowing into the area of becoming magic. This practice does this. And we reached a point where you have books, for example, that tell you each commandment, what you get for it. That's witchcraft. That is pure witchcraft.
It's, the moment it's
you
do that, superstition, right?
It's superstition and witchcraft. It's exactly what it is. So I always make sure at home that I tell my wife, you remove this piece from the bread because God has commanded you to do so, not because you're going to gain anything out of it. God has commanded you do this because, and that's why I tell my children all the time as well. They tell Abba, say to me, Abba, why are you doing this? Because God commanded. I don't go into this whole nonsense of, oh, you do this, you get this, and this is a charm for this, and if you study Torah like this, that's witchcraft. Put it aside. Actually, no, more than that. Put it in the bin and throw it out.
Very good. And I will say, too, in defense of Judaism, there is, coming from my tradition anyhow, an enormous amount of superstition and witchcraft in Christianity too, which I'm very, very thankful to be free of. But in any case, there's There's a few more Shabbat traditions.
But you should know, and this is the whole issue, and this is the same issue that went on throughout all the centuries from the giving of the Torah. The ones who are the wise people of the nation, I'm not saying I'm one of the wisest people of the nation, but I'm going to point out the ones who are thinkers understand this and point this out. But again, the majority of people, just flow with the tradition. They do whatever they're told. If you walk up to a rabbi and tell him, Rabbi, why X, Y, Z, and he might ask him, why are you asking this? Mm. If you directly ask him, no, I'm not interested in all this superstition. I want to know exactly why. He will give you a straightforward answer the same way I just did.
Okay.
But again, rabbis have to try to, this is one of the things the older rabbis were trying to do as well. They were trying to still be with the people. But the majority of people, if we do a survey of people around the world, most people are more simple-minded. And this is why not everyone thinks the way most of the people, for example, listen to the show do. Most people are sheep instead of the herdsman himself.
Mm-hmm.
And this is how society works. So people develop throughout the centuries superstitions and beliefs about certain practices, but it keeps them in the practice itself. Now, I completely disagree with that idea, but that's what happened. Mm. So in defense of Judaism, part of it has to do with basically the simpletons of the nation. There's nothing you can do about it. And it's always been like this. People have always been this way. Mm. And there's nothing you can do about it. So I want to just wrap up this, basically, not even wrap up, just try to finish off what at least a night would look like. So then people go to the synagogue, and there's a special thing. This is the real Kabbalat Shabbat. The real Kabbalat Shabbat is reading from your Siddur, from your prayer book,
yes,
a certain list of Psalms, which are from the book of Psalms, and then there's the song of the Lecha Dodi song, mm-hmm, which is a song of welcoming the Shabbat. It actually calls Shabbat a bride or a king, depends which version you have. Depends how you read the Talmud, because some of it's based on the Talmud.
Mm-hmm.
Then there's an evening prayer. People walk home. And then there's the practice. There's a song people sing about angels. I don't do that. Again, a bit of an issue there.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a song called Shalom Aleichem, which means peace on you. And they sing about these angels that go with us and be with us the whole time. It's based on something in the Talmud that speaks of two angels walk with a man during Shabbat when he leaves the synagogue. And again, this is all stories and probably idioms and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But the whole idea is that there's two angels follows each person. He goes home. If he sees a table set for Shabbat, the good angel says, may they be more like this. And the evil angel has to answer, amen.
Oh, there's a good and an evil home, angel. That's the idea.
Sorry, I forgot that. There's a good and evil angel. And if he walks home and says, as if it's a regular day, that evil angel says, may they be made like this. And the good angel has to answer, amen. He's forced to answer, amen. Then we sing from the song Eshet Chayil, which talks about the righteous woman. This is the end, the last section in the book of Mishlei, which would be Proverbs, a woman of valor. And there are many versions of this song.
Mm-hmm.
Go to YouTube. There's many different, some of them very nice. There's also the traditional song, the traditional tune, which I grew up with. Usually it's sung because women worked really hard to prepare the Shabbat. So it's sung really for them. And then there's the practice of Kiddush. Now, again, sanctifying something over a cup of wine is, again, very questionable.
Well, people say there's the precedent found in Bereshit chapter 14 with Melchizedek and Abraham.
I don't see a cup of wine there. I would say something else. That you have a verse in the book of Psalms that says, Kos Yeshuot Esau V'Shem Adonai Kra. So I will lift a cup of salvation. So some people say that might be it. There's actually traditions. For example, Yemenites will start Kiddush with Kos Yeshuot Esau V'Shem Adonai Kra, and they'll say, Hodula Adonai Ki Tov Ki Olam Chasdo. Thank Hashem for his mercy endures forever. Mm-hmm. So I'd say Yemenites actually start. Then some other cultures have that as well. Then we recite the Vayechul Hashemayim Va'aretz, basically the verses when the creation has ended. So we're talking about the verses in Genesis, I think it's Genesis 2. Yeah, exactly, Genesis 2,
yep,
verses 1 to 3.
Mm-hmm.
And then we say blessing, the classic pattern, blessed our Lord, King of the Universe, who has made the fruit of the vine.
Mm-hmm.
And then we say a special blessing about sanctifying Israel and choosing Israel and giving us the Sabbath, for it is a covenant between us. And it's the beginning for all sanctified days or appointed times. And then they say Mikadesh, they say in the end you say bless the Lord, mm-hmm. who has sanctified the Sabbath. There's even a version from the land of Israel, it's called from the Jerusalem Talmud, actually says we have sanctified Israel and the Sabbath. There's even a version like that. You drink from the wine, then people go wash their hands. Well, washing your hands doesn't mean soap and water, though it's a good idea to wash your hands with soap and water before you eat.
Sure.
But you wash your hands with a lever, it's like a small cup, and mm-hmm. you pour water over your hands.
Mm-hmm.
And then dry hands, and then you bring two loaves of bread, specifically two loaves of bread. And there's a very interesting custom because you put the loaf of bread on a cutting board, and then you cover the bread with this piece of cloth,
mm-hmm.
some of it embroidered and everything. Now, this basically is supposed to represent the manna, because that's how I was taught as a child. It makes sense. So two loaves representing two portions,
mm-hmm.
and then a layer underneath and a layer on top representing the layer of dew, which was underneath and above, or at least the ground underneath and the layer of dew above the manna itself.
Right, okay.
And you lift the bread up, you say a blessing over the bread, and you give it out to everyone. The practice is to dip it in salt. And there's always, all the meals have salt on the table, and it's the issue of salt covenant and the table being type of an altar. Again, it's kind of interesting, but if you learn salt covenants and stuff like that, you might get the understanding of what it is. You don't have to do that. And then you just start off a meal, and a meal can be whatever you want. Really, there's no specifications.
Okay.
A lot of Jews would have roasted chicken and mm-hmm. potatoes and vegetables, and some people have, I've been in families where there's a practice always to eat fish at one of the meals. So, for example, a Shabbat meal goes on for 3-4 hours sometimes, depends where you are. Depends if your children are old enough to have discussions and stuff like that.
Mm.
And, for example, when I was growing up, we always had a roast because my parents were from England. So there was always a tradition of having the Sunday roast. So the Jews turn it into the Shabbat roast.
Yes.
And the roast is always good on the exact day you made it. So we make a roast, keep it on the hot plate, and then we just make it and put it on the hot plate, and we eat it in the evening.
Nice.
And then there's people sing songs. It used to be that people were able to play music, and then the rabbis decided you can't play music during Shabbat.
They should bring the music back. They need to bring the music back. Oh, my goodness.
Well, we've had I've had this argument many times with many people. They just say you can't play music, so people will sing. So they have these song books for Shabbat.
You and I should start a synagogue with a guitar and a didgeridoo.
Well, there already are synagogues with music.
Didgeridoo. Show me a synagogue with a didgeridoo.
Yeah, well, didgeridoo is not that well known in Israel in general. When I used to go to didgeridoo practice and have this thing on my back because they have the special bag, people are stopping me in the street and see where it is. I had a green bag for it. So it was one time there was an operation in Gaza, and I was in Samaria, and someone was convinced it was just kind of some kind of a long rifle I have in a backpack or something.
Kind of bazooka or something.
Yeah, exactly. Someone asked, is that a weapon? I'm like, no, it's a musical instrument. Then, people sing, people have a very joyous time, and then they say a blessing over the food. There's always like Torah quizzes, and someone says what's called Dvar Torah, word of Torah, where someone gives like an explanation. And, by the way, I forgot to mention this, the candles are lit before sunset.
Yes.
Okay, I don't remember if I mentioned that, but candles are lit before sunset. So they haven't
kindled a fire on the Shabbat, but they've lit them before Shabbat, and it continues to burn throughout.
Exactly. And then, people hang out, people have nibble things. But a Shabbat meal is something that's very heavy, something that's very light, depends who you are.
Mm-hmm.
There's no actual specific practice. People usually have a long night. People usually go to sleep around 10 o'clock at night. Some people go to sleep at 11 or 12, go to sleep around 10. Because you're tired from the week, go to sleep. Now, when you wake up in the morning, you go to synagogue. Going to synagogue, by the way, Orthodox Jews will not drive to the synagogue. So most people have a walking distance synagogue from their home.
Mm-hmm.
This is why in Israel, every town has like 9 bazillion synagogues because no one wants to walk now 3-4 miles to their synagogue.
Sure.
Now you go in again. There's a morning prayer which starts with psalms, then reciting the Shema, done morning and evening, reciting the Shema. The Amidah, the silent prayer, And then it's a shortened version of the silent prayer, by the way. It has the three first, three last, and something in the middle about Shabbat.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's a reading from the Torah. And then there's what's called the Musaf, which is a special prayer in commemoration of the special Shabbat sacrifices. Reading of Torah, there's also a reading from the Haftarah, which is a reading from in the prophets. It has to do either with something has to do with the Torah portion we just read, or something that has to do with the commemoration of something during that day, if it's a festival or something. Then people go home and they have a second meal. So usually we have three meals during Shabbat, because mm-hmm. in ancient times, people really had two meals during a day. So there was the evening meal we just spoke about, and then there's the morning meal. And again, same thing, you do a kiddush over a cup. Mm-hmm. Here, most people recite verses from Exodus, I think it's Exodus 30, if I remember exactly. Let me look at it for a moment. I'll tell you exactly which verse it is.
Sure.
It says that Israel will keep the Sabbath for all generations. We're talking about Exodus 31, verse 16, 17, and 18. We read mm-hmm. that, then we say blessing over the wine, and we start another meal. So one of the things is that a lot of people have their meat meal in the morning, because it's already almost afternoon. It's like until you're done with synagogue, mm-hmm. it could be 11 o'clock in the morning, almost 12. So during a short Shabbat, when the sun sets early, some people would have a lighter meal and then have the heavy meal later on. Again, quizzes, everything, same thing. A lot of people go to sleep, and some people would go to study. It really depends who they are. If it's a person who's working, a lot of people will just take a nap, hour or two nap, and then get up and go to the synagogue and take 2 hours of studying Torah. Then we have the afternoon prayer. Again, read from the Torah. The next Shabbat Torah portion, we read a few verses, at least 10 verses.
Mm-hmm.
No Haftarah, though there used to be a practice of reading Haftarah in the land of Israel 2,000 years ago, but we don't do that anymore.
Mm.
And then people go back home for another meal. So basically, by the end of Shabbat, you're probably stuffed like a chicken. we're not done. There's even a special evening meal just to let Shabbat leave. So again, it's kind of silly. But one of the restaurants I worked at was a Mahadrin restaurant, which means it was a super duper kosher restaurant. Uh-huh. So all the ultra Orthodox people will come.
Yep.
And there was one evening I never worked after Shabbat, because we're supposed to work only 6 days a week. We're never asked to work 7 days a week.
Mm-hmm.
But there was one case when I was asked to come over after Shabbat. So I worked Friday, and then I had like 24 hours, 25 hours, and then I was called back to work.
Mm.
And I walk in, and we start cooking, and I peek out from the door, and I notice the place is packed with people. And I'm like, I actually said very out loudly, "You ate throughout the entire Shabbat, and you're still eating?" And someone actually overheard me and giggled. But I had a kippah on my head, so they get the idea.
Mm.
They get the idea. This is coming from an Orthodox person, so it's not. And that's really how Shabbat goes by. So, there's no television, there's no music, there's no computer. People read, you walk into a Jewish household, there's a lot of books. It depends what kind of house, but religious houses usually have a lot of books in their house. Mm-hmm. Kids are used to read from a very young age.
Mm.
My son is 7 years old. He's read quite a few books up to now. Children will sit down and play. Sometimes, they'll study and then they'll sit down and play games. It's a very family time. There's no TV interfering. There's no radio interfering. There's no computer interfering. You just shut yourself from the international news and anything that's going on, and you commune. You're with your family. You invite friends over. You invite friends over in the afternoon. You invite friends over for a light meal. It's an issue of being together, but also forgetting about work, forgetting about everything in your life. And just focus in on relaxing, and when you relax, it also helps your mind kind of like open up to the issue of the Torah, open up to belief, open up to, being with God. I know I used to meditate during Shabbat. I used to, when I was living up in the mountains in Israel, I used to sit there and just start contemplating issues of Torah, contemplating issues of existence. And when you're done with that, you get up and you feel as if you're driven to follow Torah even more.
Mm.
So this is something I always tell people. It's good to pre-prepare your food. That's the women out of the kitchen. If the woman's the one cooking, all you have to do is just heat up the food and you can just be relaxed. If you need to sleep, you'll sleep. But you can sit there on your porch if you have one with a Bible and be relaxed and be able to focus on what you're reading. So it's Shabbat is like, it's what we call pleasure. It says in one of the prophets, "V'karata Shabbat onig," and you shall call it for the Sabbath, call the Sabbath a pleasure, a
yeah,
a delight.
Isaiah 58, I believe.
I'll take your word for it. And that's really, if you want to take the personal wish of what a Shabbat is for me, I've been working very, very, very hard throughout the years. I've, you know, working as a cook, working as a baker, a lot of hours and everything. And Shabbat was always the time that you can sit down and let your mind expand. And that's when I always had my deepest thoughts. And that's what it is. And I have a lot of friends who are very hard workers. I know someone asked in the comments, you know, they said, do we have to work 6 days a week? And I said, no, but there are bosses that think that you do have to.
I would like to think that you should.
Yeah, exactly. So if anyone had a question about that, no, the answer is you're not commanded to work 6 days. You're told you're allowed to work 6 days a week,
mm-hmm.
and the Sabbath you have to rest.
Mm.
And that's an overview of what Shabbat is like in most communities.
It's beautiful. It is. And it's, so what you paint is a picture of community, a picture of enjoying food and discussing and or meditating on Torah and resting, which is just the whole idea, is to take a break and get out of the work mindset and into a Torah restful community mindset, enjoying the blessings that God has given us, right?
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Beautiful.
Exactly.
Do you know what we should do? For maybe for part four, tell me what you think of this. If you choose some of your favorite prayers that go on in the synagogue, because, you know, not a lot of us, particularly coming from my tradition, have even been in a synagogue. And I remember when I first went to a synagogue, and it wasn't a service, and it wasn't that long ago, that I felt like a fish out of water, and I totally felt like a synagogue rookie. And I just thought, man, I should have been better prepared for this. And so... there are some prayers that are just obviously they're said in the Hebrew, but they're beautiful, and it would be good to know specifically what they're about and what they say. Do you think perhaps we could, if you just choose a few of your favorites, maybe that could be part four of Shabbat?
It's an idea. It's an idea. We can do that. It's not that difficult. These are prayers I've been saying for years and years and years and years. So, yeah, we can do that. We can talk about specific prayers, and we can talk about specific practices in the synagogue.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a great idea. We should do that.
Maybe that'll be part four. In the meantime, any comments or questions are most welcome from you, the dear listener. And we've been speaking with Yoel Ben Shlomo, the Levite in the land. And we appreciate your time, my friend. Thank you for coming and telling us about Shabbat and giving us just an outline of how the day flows.
Exactly. So I hope everyone benefits from this. And I'm very happy that I was able to share. This is actually one of the more beautiful sides of Judaism. And I hope everyone will be able to adapt this to their own personal lives. It's a good thing. It's a really, really good thing. Indeed. Switch your computer off. Switch your TV off. Be with your family and read a book.
Nice. And be with your God. And so, so again, thank you, Yoel Ben Shlomo, my Hebrew teacher. His email address, by the way, is HebrewInIsrael@gmail.com. HebrewInIsrael@gmail.com if you want quality Hebrew lessons from this very knowledgeable man. But in the meantime, dear listeners, be blessed, be set apart by the truth of our Father's word. Shalom.
Shalom.